This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, is Donald Trump a white supremacist? Margaret Kimberly says yes, and he's head of a white supremacist country. Ajamu Baraka calls out the Congressional Black Caucus for supporting Donald Trump's gargantuan war budget, and trial is set for November for activists that tore down a Confederate statue in Durham, North Carolina. But first, Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, has been in St. Louis, where a cop who verbally vowed to kill a young black man and then proceeded to shoot him to death was found not guilty by a judge. Yeshitela is worried that a disturbing new norm is setting into the cycle of police atrocity and black response.
The community is righteously upset because the Africans here in St. Louis were a part of the Ferguson resistance, experienced the Ferguson resistance, and so they're in the streets again. They could anticipate it. Before the verdict was actually read by the judge, they knew the verdict was going to happen. They showed the National Guard being mobilized and someplace on standby. They had people acting like Hurricane Irma was coming, boarding up the windows in the commercial districts and things like that, and just got prepared for the demonstrations that were going to be happening. And what is really striking is that it has become a norm. And the norm is that the police kill us, bring out the National Guards or the police, pay the grieving family members, survivors, some kind of money, board up the businesses, and then more or less weather the demonstrations and what have you, and a few broken windows, that's going to happen. It's extraordinary, because if you have an opportunity to watch this on TV, it's almost like a circus, that the people will come out, and many of them are dancing in the streets and what have you, which is not to understate the significance of this resistance to African people, because the African community is extraordinarily upset, and people, a lot of the people out in the streets are upset, but a lot are demonstrating. And so that's where we are faced with. How do we move beyond this new norm where the cops killed somebody, the establishment affects us in some horrible way that clearly exposes the relationship, the real relationship that black people have to this system, and you just simply have the demonstrations, the police, and that's it. Until the people are exhausted from the series of demonstrations, and things go back to the situation. And that's not just here in St. Louis, Ferguson area. That's where we are throughout this country. And that's the thing that we are grappling with in some ways right now. It's not a mystery of what is happening, of course, is that this government succeeded generations ago killing off revolutionaries and destroying revolutionary organizations. And revolutionary organizations were not organizations fighting for body cameras and stuff like that, but actually struggling to change the overall relationship we have with this system. People are talking about black power and freedom and independence and getting the government off our backs. So that's where we need to be, but that's not a part of the agenda today, because the government succeeded in destroying the revolutionary organizations, generally speaking. And that's the thing that we're trying to work with right now, is to take that back into the mix, because we have to be there when we have these kinds of mobilizations, uprising, what have you. The revolutionary forces have to go in and have to try and win people through recognition that in this particular incident, this particular contradiction, there is a universal contradiction that we have to deal with as a people. And essential to that is the fact that we live under colonial domination, that when the police kills a black person or the judge frees the killer of an African person, it's not because the system made a mistake. It's not because somebody doesn't have appropriate training or sensitivity. It's because of a colonial relationship And colonialism acts this way all the time. Therefore, part of what we have to do is develop a position, a politic, and a capacity to intervene into these struggles to help all of these people who are so excited and who are open to a real criticism of the system, really help them to criticize the system as opposed to simply criticizing the incident. And the system is one of colonial domination of black people. We need self-determination, and that's the message that we have to take into the mix. So we have to have organizers who are out there with banners and things like that and placards raising these critical kinds of slogans, pushing us toward independence, pushing us toward self-determination. We have to have people who are in the mix, both in the middle of these mobilizations that's happening and in the communities, raising up the question of the colonial domination of our people and how we have to have self-determination. And at least when this becomes the fundamental theme that's out there, then the tactics that people use, whether they are blocking interstates or doing anything, at least lead towards some kind of objective that the people can understand. And we talk about black community control of police. That was one of the most important things that the Black is Black Coalition has put forth, is the whole campaign for black community control of the police. Because at least when you talk about black community control of the police, you're moving us in the direction of self-determination. We are in charge of our own affairs, and that's the kind of thing that has to happen, and that's what has to be won. And that's part of what it is that we're trying to do right here in St. Louis right now.
Well, certainly the police seem to understand that it's a question of power. Not only did they, in your words, weather the hurricane black folks, but they seem to be celebrating. They were chanting, "Whose streets are streets?" And the police chief, in a celebratory fashion, said, "I'm proud to tell you that the city of St. Louis is safe and the police owned tonight." So it's a question of power as far as they're concerned.
It is, and when you look at it on TV, it's almost like a circus. And I'm looking at the news, and the newscasters are saying that in Belmar Loop, this sort of yuppie area of clubs and businesses and things like that, young entrepreneur, white hip entrepreneurs, they said, look, you can't get there using this direction. Just simply go around it, and then you can get there. It's like there was no element of crisis associated with the announcement. It was like the kinds of announcements you get regularly from traffic reports with the news. And so there is no crisis in the system. It's almost as though, again, we anticipate this is going to happen. We've learned how to deal with it when it does happen. And after it's over, then it's not assumed that the people will be any closer to an answer to dealing with this than they were before it happened. And people can become exhausted over a period of time simply demonstrating. That's the kind of thing that we're looking at. And like I said, you know, you see the people lined up, and I know from afar people are watching this on TV, and people will become excited, and that helps us to know what it is that we should do when this happens in Houston or when this happens in some other place, because we see what's happening here in St. Louis. But we have to be better organized, and we have to interject. We have to intervene in these situations and really help raise the ideological and political understanding of the masses of our people who want this stuff to stop, who want to stop being oppressed and killed, et cetera. We have to raise the ideological and political level and help them to understand that the system can't do it, but we can do it as a people if we know what the hell it is we're fighting for. But to simply to be involved and to simply be out demonstrating and not having objectives that lead us toward, that challenges the existing relationship between our people and the system itself, that's a dead-end street.
Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition in St. Louis, Missouri. Ajamu Baraka, the former Green Party vice presidential nominee and veteran human rights activist, is the lead organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report, where he recently wrote an article titled, "Why Anti-Trumpism Doesn't Include Anti-War." The Democratic Party-oriented so-called resistance is against everything about Donald Trump, except his continuation of U.S. war policies around the world.
I'm not really disappointed. In fact, I'm not even surprised that this demonic character called Donald Trump, and that the focus would be on not only just domestic politics, but primarily the symbolic politics that Trump represents in terms of the kinds of bombastic rhetoric he uses, the red meat he throws to his base related to issues of race and xenophobia. It's par for the course because most of the opposition to Trump is the traditional Democrat-based opposition, along with the so-called progressive communities and even many radicals. And this process of demonizing Republicans as part of the landscape in the U.S., and now even more so with Donald Trump, because he provides them even more useful image to mobilize around and to prepare themselves for their inevitable capitulation to the politics of the Democrat Party and the next major presidential election in 2020. It would be another replay again of the lesser of two evils.
Well, certainly Donald Trump, in his address to the United Nations General Assembly, had plenty of red meat to throw to the dogs of war of both the Republican and Democratic parties, especially with his remarks about North Korea threatening nuclear annihilation.
That was an incredible moment in the history of the UN. We know that the UN has its flaws, but we do know that because of the role, theoretically, of the UN as a body that is supposed to be committed to peace, international cooperation, and human rights, that leaders of various states tend to play along with that and to moderate their rhetoric to ensure that their aggressive moves are given the proper political cover. But this particular administration, what we saw instead was a different approach, one in which he stood in that position in the UN and basically said that he was going to, or the U.S. nation state would engage in essence, a preemptive strike against the North Koreans, a act of war on front of a body, part of a process that theoretically is supposed to be committed to peace. So it was an extraordinary moment. But on another level, Glenn, it was almost one of the most honest moments. And what I mean by that is Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report pointed out a few days ago that when people were contrasting Donald Trump to Barack Obama's appearances, she reminded folks that, sure, yeah, Trump is more bombastic and crude, but Obama, in his slick in eloquent ways, came before the body of the UN, and while he did not say he was going to destroy certain nations, U.S. policy was, in fact, doing that as he spoke. He didn't say that the U.S. was going to engage in an assault on Libya with their European allies, but that's exactly what they did. They destroyed a nation. He pretended that they were concerned about democracy in Syria at first, while they systematically armed jihadists to wreak death and destruction across the Syrian landscape. He claimed to be concerned about the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan, while he simultaneously expanded the U.S. presence in that country. He reinvaded Iraq. So the symbolic use of language, the image is slightly different, but in terms of the substance of aggressive U.S. imperial policy, there's not much of a departure between the Obama policies and the naked, raw power politics of Donald Trump.
And U.S. presidential policies of the last 70 years or so in general. When was the time that North Korea was not under the threat of nuclear annihilation? And Iran has been a target of the United States ever since it got rid of the Shah. and Venezuela has been subverted ever since they had the beginnings of their revolution.
Exactly. So it's been consistent. The only difference is, again, in the symbolism, the imagery being projected, and symbolism and imagery primarily for the U.S. audience, because most people in the world and the international Gallup polls have supported this. Most people in the world see the U.S. as, in fact, the country that is responsible for most of the death and destruction. They see the U.S. as the number one threat to peace and stability on the planet. So the imagery and those kinds of weapons used to placate the American people have been primarily directed toward that objective, to build support for the aggressive U.S. policies on behalf of maintaining the global dominance of the world of the 1%. So that kind of consistency is something that we have seen continue with the Trump administration. As you indicated, there's been no attempt on the part of any of the administrations since the Korean War to resolve the Korean conflict. And of course, the Korean authorities have seen over the last decade what has happened to countries that found themselves in the crosshairs of U.S. aggression. And they have decided that they have a right and a responsibility to defend their nation. And that means producing the weapons they feel necessary in order to, in fact, do that. So while we would like to see an elimination of nuclear weapons, and definitely don't want to see a proliferation of nuclear weapons until the situation with North Korea is resolved, until the North Koreans can feel that they are not under the threat of annihilation, then it's hypocritical for us to criticize that nation's attempt to try to defend the integrity of its process. So North Korea, the destabilization in Venezuela and the threats of intervention in Venezuela, the continuation of the wars in various countries from Yemen through Syria, the subversion of AFRICOM on the African continent, the expansion of U.S. military training and military-to-military relations with strong man dictators in various parts of the world. We see a continuation of U.S. policy, but a continuation in a global environment that's more dangerous than ever before. And so it is time that those of us who believe that we are part of the progressive community, that we re-embrace the strategic objective and the principal commitment to a anti-war and anti-imperialist position, something that has been absent, something that helps to explain why certain politicians can be characterized as progressive, while at the same time they will uphold and advance a pro-U.S. imperialist position beyond the borders of the U.S. And that's why the anti-Trumpism does not include a commitment to war, because as we have seen, both major political parties and most of the progressive communities seems to be in support of U.S. interventions. The justifications may be different for the progressives and even for some of the radicals based on this flawed notion of the responsibility to protect. But the objective result is that they find themselves on the same side with U.S. aggressive intervention and regime change. So you can have anti-Trumpism without having anti-war and pro-peace position, and definitely no anti-imperialist position.
Yes, U.S. war policy not only is bipartisan, it's also biracial, with, as you point out, most of the Congressional Black Caucus going along with Trump's $700 billion war budget.
That is one of the most obscene developments that I've seen in a few years, that part of the fact that you don't have an anti-war posture among the anti-Trump opposition is, again, because a lot of that opposition, or a major portion of that opposition, is still connected to the Democrat Party and their NGOs and community-based organizations. But even then, you know, there's always been some degree of cover for their pro-war positions. But the fact that in the midst of this concern with Donald Trump, that 117 Democrats, with the majority of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, voting in favor of this obscene increase in military spending, this is something quite different. I talked about in my piece that for a moment, some of the liberal Democrats were attempting to make an issue out of what they characterized as an obscene request on the part of the Trump administration to increase military spending by $54 billion. But all of a sudden, they went quiet on that issue. And I think they went quiet because they felt like within the confines of the Democratic Party, this was not going to gain much traction. They also understood, I think, correctly that the Democrats were going to be on board with that increase. And indeed, they were. And not only was the increase, not only did the military spending increase, it increased beyond the $54 billion proposal by the Trump administration. The increase is something around $75 billion. So the House, the vote in the House in July on the National Defense Authorization Act, which served as the foundation for the Pentagon budget, 117 Democrats voted in favor of expanding the military budget to $696 billion. That was followed by the recent vote on Monday in the Senate. So the issue of opposing the military budget, the Democrats, that issue is really off the table. It is up to us to bring that issue back to the people, especially when we know that as part of the appropriation stage of this budget process, that this increase in military spending is going to be connected to reducing the expenditures of almost every major federal agency in the federal government, except probably Homeland Security. So there's going to be a measurable impact, a measurable negative impact on the conditions, the plight of poor people and working people who are dependent on these vital services coming from the federal government and from the state governments that receive support from the federal government as a consequence of this obscene increase in military spending.
That sounds like the guns or butter argument, which you describe as a potential ideological opening to oppose this increased militarization.
Exactly, and that's what we have to do. We can no longer allow ourselves to define ourselves as progressives, so-called radicals, only focus on the domestic contradictions of the U.S. economy. We've got to connect up these issues of state repression and the military instrument, because the U.S. state is using fear to mobilize the people in order to support these kinds of obscene, wasteful moves with the public's resources. And we know that they do that because they have to, that the military option, the option of repression, is really now the most important instrument that they have, because they are, in fact, experiencing a legitimation crisis. So strengthening the repressive apparatus of the state domestically, using military force globally to attempt to block the Chinese and to prevent the Russians and the Iranians from effective engagement in the international economy. This is the option that they are, in fact, using now. So for us, understanding that, if we're able to organize and mobilize opposition to the military budget and military spending, we have a chance to not only advance a clearer understanding of how those resources can be used to address the real material needs of the people internally, but we also have an opportunity to weaken the state, weaken its ability to wage war and to be repressive internally. So we have this strategic opportunity, if only we can recognize its importance and begin to focus our attention on building an effective opposition to, in fact, do that.
And regarding the Black Alliance for Peace, what about the possibilities of shaming this Black Caucus? The whole continent of Africa is a theater of war and occupation by AFRICOM, and yet we hear almost nothing from the Congressional Black Caucus about U.S. war policies in Africa.
And one of the main reasons I think, Glenn, that we don't hear much from the Congressional Black Caucus is that because they have been allowed to get away with being silent, especially over the last 8 years, in which there was a shift in terms of the almost natural critical perspective that the Black community had when it came to war and aggression related to U.S. foreign policy. That changed under Obama. The Obama influence resulted in Black folks having a less critical stance on these issues of war and peace and U.S. imperialism. So our responsibility is to, in this period, and now that people are thinking again, is to refocus our attention in order to expose the real interest in play so that we can create accountability for these Black representatives. We've got to organize in their districts, raising the people's consciousness so that people can begin to demand more responsible positions on the part of the Congressional Black Caucus. We want the members of the Congressional Black Caucus to have to explain to the people why there's going to be the kind of significant cuts that would take place with federal expenditures in these vital areas of services that people are dependent on because of the increase in the military spending and the fact that they supported that. So old-fashioned direct organizing and public educational activity is what the Black Alliance for Peace is intending to engage in order to have more accountability and to bring about a situation in which we can begin to move those elements out of their positions as part of a transitional plan and insert people in those positions who are willing and committed to standing with the people and protecting and advancing the interests of the people and not the interests of the 1%.
Yes, certainly Donald Trump is anathema to the overwhelming portion of the Black community, and the caucus should be challenged as to why it stands with Trump in terms of war and in terms of war in Africa.
That is the contradiction that has to be raised. That you pretend that you're so oppositional, Donald Trump, yet you still will support policies that the Trump administration is advancing that appears to be or can be seen as against your own interests, not only in the U.S., but also abroad. That you're concerned about violence from the state in the U.S., but you say nothing about the expanded violent activity, the training of militaries, in many cases very repressive militaries on the African continent, the constructed conflicts that are being waged on the African continent to create the pretext for more U.S. intervention. So if you're concerned about these issues, if you're concerned about and committed to taking real, consistently progressive positions in line with our traditions and our interests, then you have to disconnect from the traditional Democrat Party talking points and positions on these issues of war and militarism. And if you can't, and we're talking to these Black representatives, then you're going to be called out. And that is what we intend to do. Just vote for the increase in military spending. It's going to be something that we're going to be able to, I think, effectively capitalize off of.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace. Is Donald Trump a white supremacist? Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly says, yes, of course. And the very presence of Donald Trump in the White House is proof of the endemic nature of white supremacy in the United States. Kimberly wrote an article for Barr titled, Trump and America are White Supremacist. She says too many folks try to treat Trump as some kind of special case.
It's easy to focus on an individual, in particular this man who became president. It's easy to focus on the people who are self-proclaimed white supremacists. That lets everybody else off the hook. We also have a recent controversy with an ESPN reporter who tweeted that Trump was a white supremacist and people attacked her and Black people defended her. It was, I suppose, an interesting turn of events, but it evades the issue of white supremacy in the country, the very supremacist founding of this country as a colonial settler state that nearly exterminated the native population, that made its wealth on the backs of enslaved African people. So, yes, it is true. It's just, to me, a silly question. Trump won. He is president because he's a white supremacist. So the answer is yes, but 60 million people voted for him. So instead of pointing fingers at him and engaging in what I think is a silly debate about this particular individual, we should spend our time talking about what to me is very obvious evidence of white supremacy in this country, as in the entire system.
Yes, on the face of it, one should conclude that, yes, of course, President Trump is a racist, and he was rewarded for it with the White House.
Yes, he was. And it's interesting, he knew his people better than anybody else did, better than the rest of the Republicans, who, as the de facto white people's party for nearly 50 years now, have depended on getting white votes and assuming that those voters all went along with their ideology. And Trump proved that many of them don't care about tax cuts, don't care about defense spending, don't care more about being white. And from the moment he said that, I believe in retrospect, that he was going to build a wall on the Mexican border, I think that's when he won, not the popular vote, but he won enough states to win in the Electoral College. He appealed directly to white people. He made it clear that he was make America great again means making them great again, if not great again, more stable again, because they are suffering, of course, not the way black people do, from the economic downturn, from this late stage capitalism. So he is the one who surprised the rest of the Republican establishment by really being the white person's candidate more than anybody else. And it wasn't Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz or any of these other people that they thought it was going to be.
Yes, we have folks now who are ascribing every example of police savagery against blacks to Trump, saying things like, "Welcome to Trump's America," as if this wasn't the America that we had before Trump.
Yeah, we know that black persons killed by the police every day. We know that three people, every single day, the police in this country kill three people. The other two people are collateral damage because white supremacy demands that the police force be this modern-day slave patrol, and sometimes they are victims too. But this didn't start on January 20th. And it's interesting, everything that people don't like, many people act as though it didn't start until Inauguration Day this year. Well, the police didn't start killing people January 20th. ICE didn't start deporting people on January 20th. Obama deported. He was the deporter in chief. We'll see if that record holds up. With Obama had more than 2.5 million deportations as president. The war machine doesn't stop. So all of the things that were so terrible about the country that exist now existed before. And I think it's important to point that out and not think that resisting Trump is an answer. We have an entire system to resist. We have another political party, the Democrats, who must be resisted. They were too stupid to even be able to beat him. So there's a lot of resistance that has to happen, and it cannot be focused on Trump. That is, in my opinion, a losing proposition.
Yes, you talk about the sport, now popular among liberals, of shooting fish in the barrel of Klansmen and neo-Nazis. An easy thing to do, but one that does not get to the heart of endemic racism in America.
Yeah, everyone gets to pat themselves on the back. The Confederate monument controversy, this all starting in Charlottesville, where the self-proclaimed alt-right had a rally to defend Robert E. Lee's statue, and a woman ended up being killed by one of them. So it's easy to fight against them, and we need to. It is a bad thing. I don't mean to dismiss how terrible it can be for black people, for individual white people to feel emboldened and empowered to act on their racist motivations. But we can't let people be satisfied if they pull down a monument or chased some neo-Nazis out of town. Every other march they've had, they've been overwhelmed by progressive protesters. There was a Trump rally, and supposed to be rally in Washington a few days ago. I think they had 100 people. It was something rather sad, but we can't let that be the definition of progress. And I also mentioned that we can see very clearly, there's evidence, there's data of the power of white supremacy still in this society. It was recently revealed that black people are the only group who've gone backwards economically. The only thing we have is our income. And since 2000, we're the only group. Asians have gotten ahead, Latinos and white people have gotten ahead, black people have lost a couple thousand dollars a year, it's the median income. Who gets arrested the most? Who is killed by police the most? Who is victimized by law enforcement in a variety of ways? Who's restricted about where they can live and where they can go to school? It's black people. So if a Robert E. Lee monument is taken down, but none of the rest of that changes, then there's nothing to celebrate.
Yes, as you point out, black people on comparable and raw figure levels have bounced back to pre-1979. That's two generations.
Yes, it is. It's quite terrible, and it's something that is not discussed enough. I think Obama becoming president, frankly, created this, and it's something that the system does anyway, trying to dismiss the facts of our lives, and then having a black president and many black people being impressed by this black president and actually telling pollsters they believe that their lot was improving. I think it became easier to hide the desperation of black people. We have not recovered from the 2008 financial collapse. It stole what little wealth we had, most of it tied up in our homes. And if you look at any measure, we are doing worse. And it is something that continues not to be discussed. But I think this is a moment to talk about that and not to allow Trump to be this focal point, which also helps. It lets so many people off the hook. It lets the black misleaders off the hook. They think all they have to do is talk about how horrible Trump is and then tie him with Putin, and they get to be patted on the back and called eloquent when they don't do anything to help us. Use the powers that they could have to at least speak up, to at least use their power to bring attention to our needs, and they don't even do that.
Yes, and they don't seem embarrassed at all that the president who presided over the worst economic disaster for black people in modern times is picking up $400,000 checks per pop for speeches to banks.
Yes, and defend him. And that has become the newest foolishness. People defending him, saying, well, you know, the white president's got to cash in, so Obama should be able to cash in too. And they all did. All of the former presidents have become very wealthy. Obama just started a foundation. I'm sure Obama, being who he is, it won't be so obviously predatory as the Clinton Foundation, but I'm sure he will become richer because of that too, with the influence peddling that comes with the office. And it's very sad that many people will be happy, will be proud of him, that he not only became president, but that he's going to personally become more wealthy as well. But it's not just a matter of his ethics. It tells you who runs the country and the world, that it's finance capital that does, and that that's an enemy to be opposed.
And these black misleaders in and out of office seem to spend more time since the past election talking about Russians than talking about the plight of black folks.
Yes, and as you wrote in your column a couple of weeks ago, it's very clear Republicans have been stealing black votes for years, and the Democrats say nothing about it. And the New York Times wrote a story about the Republicans trying to steal black votes in North Carolina, but except they claimed it was the Russians who did it. There's another story today. In 21 states, they say, Russia meddled in the election. It's nothing but the usual of Republicans hacking into machines and making sure that black votes don't count. But that's something that black legislators, that should be the bare minimum for them, to talk about how their constituents have their voting rights stolen from them. But they haven't said anything about it, except they continue to lie about Russia, and there's a Russian lie every day that Russia spent money on Facebook, that the Russians stole votes. It's amazing the lengths they have gone to, and it's amazing that black politicians have gone right along with it.
Yes, it is amazing. The Facebook controversy revolves around an alleged spending by alleged Russians of about $100,000 over 2 years. That's $50,000 a year. And yet American elections cost in the billions.
Yes, they do. And not only that, but there are other countries that quite openly work to influence American politics, Israel being the most obvious example, but not just Israel, other countries do too. And it's accepted, and there's silence about it. And while there's no proof of any Russian meddling, it's very obvious, it's very upfront that Israel and its allies control Congress, control local election. Here in New York City, where I live, local elected officials, city and state people who have nothing to do with foreign policy make these regular treks to Israel. And that means, of course, they can raise campaign money. But this is flagrant. Everybody knows it. The press knows it. The politicians know it. The people know it. But no one says anything about it. But every day now, there's a new story about Russian influence. John McCain put in the recent defense bill that would deprive RT, used to be Russia Today, of the ability to broadcast in the United States. Russia Today, its ratings are so low, they don't even appear in the Nielsen ratings. They have something that's estimated like 30,000 viewers a day. People can't find it on cable, but we're told that RT stole the election and is trying to influence our politics. And it's a steady drumbeat. And it seems like it's foolish or ridiculous, but it's actually very dangerous because the goal is to get Americans in the mood to have a war.
Meanwhile, more than half of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor of Donald Trump's gargantuan military budget.
Yes, they did. And an increase of $75 billion, which, by the way, is the total amount of Russia's defense budget. The U.S. defense budget is 10 times as big. But yes, they went along with that. They went along with not taking away Trump's war powers that actually have been given to presidents ever since Bush. And Democrats went along with those as well. So there's a lot of resisting that has to be done. And I think, frankly, it has to start with the Democrats first. I think they must be resisted first.
You don't see it as a party that can somehow be saved from within.
No, I don't see that at all. The contradiction is that Democrats depend on corporate money. They depend on wealthy individuals. And everything they could do to reverse their recent defeats, they can't do. It's very simple. They have to give people something that will help them. It's not brain surgery. There should be Medicare for all. The minimum wage should be a living wage. But they cannot take money from their supporters and advocate on those issues. So they are hamstrung by the way in which they've chosen to build their party. They're defeating themselves. It's not like we have a lot of work to do, but I think we have to be deliberate and be conscious about creating real left politics so we can have a real peace party. We can have a real workers' party. It's clearly not going to be the Democrats.
Margaret Kimberly, author of the weekly Freedom Rider column in Black Agenda Report. Takiya Thompson, a 22-year-old student and member of the Workers' World Party, is among the activists facing felony charges in Durham, North Carolina, for tearing down a statue of a Confederate soldier this summer. The trial is scheduled for November. We asked Ms. Thompson how she and her co-defendants have been holding up.
I think myself and other folks are just taking it day by day. There are times when this whole ordeal is tiring mentally and emotionally and physically. So I think people are doing their best to try to maintain their personal health. But I think on like a broader scale, thinking about bigger picture, I think people are feeling good and feeling rejuvenated by the action that we took. And if I had to characterize the sheriff, policing is a white supremacist institution. People who participate in that institution are participating in the furthering of white supremacy, period. So that's how I would characterize Sheriff Mike Andrews.
And what about the response that you've gotten from the Durham community?
Day after day, people have been showing up and organizing to show support. After August 14th, every couple of days, the Sheriff's Department would issue new warrants, and people would be turning themselves, and every single day there would be jail support. I believe it was the 17th, a few days after the August 14th action, where the statue was toppled. Folks showed up in mass to turn themselves in, to basically send a message to the sheriff. People showed up in mass on the 17th to turn themselves in, basically to show support for the arrestees and to say that if they're guilty of tearing down white supremacy, then I am too. That same day, there was a massive anti-Klan uprising in the streets of Durham, where it's estimated that 1,000 people came out to protest against the Klan. You know, there were reports of folks seeing white supremacists in the area and reports that they were being sheltered inside of the Durham County Sheriff's Office and stuff like that. So, yeah, the Durham community has really shown up in a big way and consistently, and I think that's very important.
Well, certainly there's been a chilling effect against you and the other defendants because under lawyers' advice, you can't talk about certain elements of what happened, but you appear to be saying that there's not been a chilling effect among anti-racists in Durham in general.
No, because I said it before to the folks in Durham, and I'm constantly reiterating this, that I think the consciousness of the folks in Durham is very high. And the people who show out consistently and organize around so many different fronts and are able to put away their different political tendencies and viewpoints for a greater cause, I think is really important. I think the people of Durham have this understanding that struggle is not an event, it's a lifetime commitment. And the people show out consistently because they have that understanding.
And I read that there's still discussion about the disposition of that statue, that there's actually a possibility of it being restored.
Yeah, I've been hearing stories most recently about the statue being put on private property, which that really highlights the flaw in this liberal understanding of freedom of speech, right? Because if we're going to allow this statue to remain on private property, we're emboldening Klan activity, right? If we track the Klan activity through the years in the United States, whenever the Klan is marginalized and pushed away from making public statements and holding public rallies, they rally themselves on private property. What do you think is going to happen to these statues? It's just going to become a private rallying point for the Klan. And the Klan doesn't need to be privatized. It needs to be squashed. It needs to be eliminated. It doesn't need to exist.
And the Klan has a history of mass murder in recent years in North Carolina.
Yeah, absolutely. The Greensboro Massacre is a perfect example.
What kind of solidarity and specific assistance have folks in Durham gotten from around the country?
People have been supporting all throughout the country. There have been solidarity marches and solidarity actions that were held in New York, in Georgia, in LA, in Detroit. It was a week of solidarity around one of the earliest court dates, which was on the 12th, on September 12th. And there was a week of actions all the way up until the 17th. People across the country, across the globe, have been donating to our legal bond fund, which we highly appreciate, right? Those donations are so important in fighting this case and continuing the fight against injustice. People in the local community have just been coming together to use whatever skills they have to further the movement. This is something I always say, that when an organizer I met early on down here told me that everyone has a role in the revolution, right? If the revolution were to come today, we would still need doctors and electricians and engineers. We would need revolutionary janitors. It's all about how you use your skill set to be beneficial towards furthering the movement. We've had people cook for folks who are facing charges and are facing death threats, who are too stressed out to find ways to feed themselves. We've had people, electricians, installing security cameras for people who felt unsafe. A plethora of things, right? Any skill that you have, you can contribute to the revolution. And I think the people of Durham really do understand that. And that has been excellent to see. And it has helped the defendants and people who are mobilizing around this issue immeasurably.
That's Takiyah Thompson speaking from Durham, North Carolina. Mass black incarceration has been the law of the land for more than 40 years. Two generations of young people have grown old behind the bars. Charles Diggs is an incarcerated correspondent for Prison Radio in Pennsylvania's Greaterford Prison. Diggs says prisons have become warehouses for senior citizens.
In Pennsylvania, the prison population is 10% senior citizen. Those over 50 years of age are considered elderly in these prisons. Many of the prisons throughout the state have become overcrowded with the elderly, that they have separate blocks, separate housing units for them. As everyone knows, prisons was not built for older men and women. It was a young man's institution. Because most crimes, it's accepted that it's done when you're young. And what happens is that they keep you in prison for a substantial number of years. It becomes a burden on the state because the prisons aren't set up to house older men and women. And why is this such a public interest, or why should it be? And my argument is that at some point we should consider reviewing parole for those who are serving life sentences in Pennsylvania, because it's costing the state billions of dollars, and also they don't have really they're not set up to treat the medical problems that takes place with an elderly prisoner. The lawmakers have made these mandatory sentences, which turned into a death by incarceration, because even with a release system in the state for those who are elderly or terminally ill, they don't use it. Very rarely do they use it. Maybe one or two guys may get out every couple of years, but outside of that, most of the men and women, when they get old and they get sick, they pass away here. And most of the men who die in prison, the families don't even take them because they've lost, you know, touch with their families. They've been here so long, and it becomes a burden, you know, to bury someone. It costs $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. So keeping the elderly in prison is just a disadvantage for the entire system. In fact, in Pennsylvania, they have a prison called Laurel Heights, and it houses nothing but the elderly and the sick, and that costs $300 million to build that. So you can see this elderly prisoners is expanding and costing the state a lot of money. The fact is that the public is not seeing what's going on in the prisons. They're just not aware. You know, we're busy built in these rural areas. And so what you have, we're just creating employment in these different rural areas, but you're draining the public taxpayers' money, because that money could be used for schools, you know, hospitals, roads, and other things that the citizens need in society. You may want to ask the question, well, why are they keeping people in prison into old age? All I can say is that the laws began to change in the early 80s. They began to, this drug war, and this drug war meant that put more and more people in prison at any cost. But what happened, it incorporated all your other types of crimes. And what they did, they just kept packing the prisons with more and more drug cases. And then most of your murder cases, they're drug related. And so most men came in jail before they were 25 years of age, majority. So they were young too, but they're not considering that when your guy goes up for commutation, they don't consider that. They just deny, deny, deny. So now you have this massive, large prison population. We're just dying off one by one. My position would be that the society should realize men and women in jail, some are innocent, some are guilty. The fact is that there's no mechanism to really measure the maturity of that person. To say that someone after 30, 40 years, you resurrect the crime and you say they're the same person, it's not even an argument. No one's the same. Everybody changes. No matter where you are, who you are, everyone changes. So what has happened is the prison industry has taken the human factor out of being a human being. Because once you say no, a person never changes, you're saying basically they've lost all their humanity. And I would argue that that wasn't the purpose of the penal system. You know, the penal system was repentance, you know, punishment, but there was a repentance. There was a form of redemption. That these life sentences throughout Pennsylvania and the United States should be revisited by the legislator or even the governor. But even with the governor, they passed several laws that they amended constitutions in several states where the governor has no say-so in the parole or commutation of the prisoners. It has to go through a commutation board, then the governor, and you got to get all five votes. How are you going to get all five votes unanimously? It's not going to happen. So the few that do make it to the governor's desk, you know, it's not even significant reason to say they have a system. So even with the alleged system in place, it doesn't work. You know, you have the attorney general on the board, a crime victim, lieutenant governor, and two other people, you know, five people, and they're all, you know, on the side of the extensive prosecution mentality. You know, once they're in there, we're keeping them here. We're not taking any chances. And so, and this is why you have what I think is about 5,500 lifers in Pennsylvania who have no hope of parole eligibility. Like I say, every governor, they may let out two or three people, but that's not a acceptable a number of people that's being released back into society. And on top of that, those who have gotten out through the last 20 or 30 years, they're all very successful in society. None of them have returned to prison for anything major at all. So we have a good track record throughout the country. Now, the juveniles, they pass the law, they have to give them parole. They have to get reviewed for parole at some chance. So 500 of them are in prison here in Pennsylvania, and they're all being released now one by one. They've gotten up to about 50 so far. And it made the law retroactive. And it was based on their brain wasn't fully developed. And in that science, the neuroscientists concluded that the brain doesn't become fully developed until late 20s, 25, some say up to 30. But the United States Supreme Court, they cut it off at 18. So we're now litigating, trying to get the prison system to recognize the men who were convicted of their crimes. They were under 25. They should be given a chance for parole eligibility.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com. where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.